Hello, listeners. Been wondering how you can help the show? Probably not. But here are five things you can do. 1. Subscribe. Support the show by clicking the subscription link in the show notes. 2. Review on iTunes, on our website, www.afraidofnothingpodcast.com, or on whatever app you listen to. 3. Donate. When you go to our website, click the cute coffee cup icon. Or, in the show notes, click the subscription link. 4. Share. Sharing really is caring. Tell your friends, and even your enemies, to check out the show. 5. Watch. Wait a minute. It's a podcast, not a movie. Actually, it's both. Check the show notes to find out where to watch the documentary. You can also rent it on Prime Video. That's it. Oh, one last thing. Enjoy this episode.
They were drifting down out of the park to where their car was. When they reached their car, that was the last thing they remembered until 3 hours later when they showed up at a restaurant, which was normally only like 10 minutes away from where they were. They came to the support group meeting, and they had developed a rash after this. So they went to their doctor. I guess they went to two doctors, his doctor, then her doctor. And first one said, well, it's not poison ivy or poison oak, and there's a lot of poison oak up in that area. And the second doctor says, well, I don't know. It doesn't look like any of those. And is it maybe something, you know, a reaction to something? But I have no clue as to what it is. Anyway, they took a picture of their rash, and they brought it to the support group meeting. And they showed it around to the group, and almost without exception, they all said they had a similar rash at one time or another. And then one of the people in the group said, I'm pretty sure I know what it is. And so, of course, we said, what is it? And it said, it's a reaction to the fluid that they dip you in when they bring you on board the craft to sanitize you. So now, okay, that was almost 30 years ago that this happened. I got a phone call from them. I think it's 3 months now, 3 months ago. They said, she said, I can't believe it. I'm remembering now being dipped in that fluid.
In a world where nothing is known, nothing is certain, reality is not real. Wake up! Be afraid of nothing.
I'm Bob Heskey. Robert.
The host with the ghost.
This is my podcast based on my paranormal documentary, Afraid of Nothing. Each episode, we talk to people who see life and the afterlife through a different lens. Join me.
Who is this large man? And what's he doing in our bedroom?
As we lift the veil and open our minds to see beyond our eyes lie. This is Afraid of Nothing. Nothing. Lester Velez is a graduate of the University of Vermont with a Bachelor of Science degree in Business Administration. Beginning in September of 1970, he served in the U.S. Army as a field artillery officer and was later vice president of Luscombe Engineering, a Silicon Valley-based manufacturer's representative company. He joined MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, in 1991 and has held the following positions: field investigator, training coordinator for field investigators, the assistant state director in Northern California, chairman of the AERC Abduction Experience Research Committee, and team leader of the ART Abduction Response Team. Also during that time, he became a facilitator for an abduction support group in San Jose, California, and in 1994, co-founded OPUS, the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support. Les has also written the book, The Unknown Other, and the existential proposition of alien contact. His website is www.opusnetwork.org. That's www.opusnetwork.org. All right, this is a nice show that we have going here. I have Les Velez, and you heard me go over his bio, but I'm going to actually ask Les to reintroduce himself and give us kind of the high note of his background and how he got interested in the field of the paranormal and alien abduction. And before I do that, I want to note that I have my buddy Kyle Carvin on this show. So Kyle's doing a Netflix series, and he's got a break right now. So we're glad to have you on the show, Kyle.
Yeah, always happy to be here. Happy to speak with you and Les tonight.
Cool. And Les, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, guys. I really appreciate being here. And to answer your question, I have to back up a number of years, like when I was 11 years old. Okay. This is when I was living in Connecticut. And I was coming into the house. It was late October, and it was early evening after feeding my dog. I glance over to my right, and here's this object hovering over a tree line, just, you know, like a couple of hundred yards away, and not making any sound whatsoever. It was oval in shape. It was like self-illuminated, and it just kept violently moving away in a westerly, or actually an easterly direction. I scared the hell out of me, and I ran in the house to try to get my father to come out, and by the time he came out, it was gone, of course. He said, oh, it's probably just a beacon of light reflecting off a cloud or something, you know? So, but I didn't believe it at the time, based on what I was observing. And I went to the library shortly thereafter, and I thought out some books on UFOs and started to read the books by George Adamski, and who was the big author at the time in the late 50s. He was telling an incredible story, had phenomenal pictures that he had taken through his telescope of these craft and the experiences that he had with these quote-unquote Venusians. Well, I was kind of blown away for a while about this whole thing, really got into it. And then, you know, became older and life took its course and girls became a little bit more interesting and kind of forgot about the whole UFO thing. And then I went off to college, went and into the ROTC program, came out a second lieutenant in a field artillery, went in the service, had 6-year commitment, got married right before I actually went into the service, and settled in Connecticut, raised a couple of children. And in 1985, I moved out to California. I picked up the San Jose Mercury News, as it was called, and now it's just the Mercury News. Stanton Freeman, this nuclear physicist, was going to come to San Jose City College to talk about UFOs and a government cover-up. Well, it's like somebody threw a switch. And I said, oh my God, I got to go see this guy. And so I did. And I expected to see, you know, a handful of people there, but the auditorium was packed. It must have been like 300 people there. And he gave one of his inimitable lectures, fantastic job. And once again, I just was so energized. And on my way out, MUFON had a table in the foyer. They produce a monthly journal where they talk about their cases that they're involved with. So I decided, okay, I'm going to go get this journal. And I did. And I was getting that for a while. And then something said to me, this is not enough. You got to do more. So they have a field investigator training course. And I took it and I passed it and started to work with this more senior investigator on these cases that I got involved with. And, you know, I was kind of a nuts and bolts kind of a guy back in those days. So the first case that came along for me, the person says, well, you know, they talked about the object that they saw and described and all that. But then they said, you know, I also had contact with this non-human intelligence and it scared the crap out of me. And so I was very skeptical. I said, oh, really? You know, it's like, okay, this person might have some issues going on. But almost without exception, the rest of the cases that I got involved with, they were saying the same thing, that they not only saw a craft of some sort, but they also had contact with these entities. My whole worldview started to change. And then one day, one of the people that I was working with said, do you know of other people having similar experiences? And I said, yes, I do. And next thing I know, I'm facilitating a support group in my office. I was in the electronics business and had a company there and in Silicon Valley, and so we decided to have these meetings in my office because it was convenient and I had a nice big conference room, so it worked out pretty good.
All right, that's excellent, Les. When you say MUFON, you mean the Mutual UFO Network, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And when you were in the military, did you have any experiences there? I mean, a lot of times you hear about people having experiences in the military. Was there any talk about that when you were there?
No, it wasn't. And like I say, that whole subject really wasn't on my mind at the time.
Okay.
And I didn't personally have anything happen while I was in the service of that nature.
Okay.
It didn't happen until I moved out to California after I was out of the service already.
We've actually had a couple guests that have also been members of MUFON. What's like the application process?
They're always looking for investigators because as this topic gets more and more visibility, more and more cases are coming to the fore. And so I think I just responded to one of the things in the journal, like an advertisement. But you can go online. Their website is pretty good. And there's a place where you can contact them and request that. And what they'll do is there's a manual that you get. I think the cost of the manual now is, I think, close to $90. I mean, it's got a lot of good information in it. It's probably about 2 or 3 inches thick.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so once you get that, then you go through that process. And then when you feel you're ready, you can take the exam. And so what they do is they'll send you a link to where the test is. And then you can take that test and they'll let you know if you passed it or not. And I forget what the criteria is for passage. I think I got like a 98 or something on mine. But so I passed. But, it's very simple, very straightforward. The bottom line is that there's a lot of information in that manual, and they test you on a lot of it. So it's not that easy.
Yeah, that's actually, I was going to ask, like, how, because just like any kind of, I'll just use a very broad explanation and say, like, any group of people, there's always going to be bad players in any kind of conglomerate, right? So I was actually going to wonder about how there might be a process of keeping out like folks from who are truly interested in advancing the science versus just people who wanted, for whatever reason, are just like enthusiasts that just want to share some crazy stories, but they might actually be, a little insane or what
have
you.
Yeah, well, generally speaking, they hook you up with a veteran investigator on your first cases and things like that. And it becomes evident rather quickly if a person is, really dedicated or is just in there for yucks, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That has not presented any issues. Now, on the other hand, there have been investigators I know that have been let go because of what they have done during an investigation.
Interesting, yeah. Is that something you're able to mention any details of, like what kind of things that would be?
It's all over the place. I mean, some of them are a person takes offense to the language the person used or something like that,
Sure.
It's all over the place, and then so somebody is warned, but if he does it again or she does it again, then it becomes a problem. I mean, it's like in life,
Sure.
When you're dealing with people, you can offend people.
Yeah, very easily sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you got to be careful. And they talk about things like that, how to be a professional and how to, work with people. That's also part of
it. Yeah.
So Les, what about like things like cattle mutilation, or UFO sites? I mean, if you're talking to a UFO abductee, that's probably a one-on-one conversation and there's certain questions you're asking. But if you're going out to a site where there's like a cattle mutilation or something where there may be traces of UFOs and there could be some radioactive activity, how do they train you for that?
Well, actually, they cover that in the manual. That manual is really extensive and, how you cordon the area off and then to make sure that one of the investigators has a Geiger counter, the proper equipment, and then taking soil samples and how to take soil samples. You know, it's actually very extensive. And then, of course, bringing in professionals in that case, whether it's a veterinarian that you need or someone that can analyze samples of tissue, things of that nature. They've got quite an extensive list of professionals that they can utilize to look at a lot of this. The organization has come quite far with regard to being able to really do a professional job when it comes to investigating these cases, even cattle mutilation cases.
So MUFON is all across the country. Are there any hotbeds regions in the country where you get your most cases from?
Well, yeah, typically Florida, Texas, and California are pretty much where we get most of the cases, simply because of the population densities. But there are some other areas where there's high strangeness. Certainly you've heard about Utah, Skinwalker Ranch. You know, and then there's a place in Missouri. I can't remember the name of it offhand right now, but there's been some really strange things going on there for years. They publish on a monthly basis the sightings report, where you can see by state and then also by country. This is an international organization. It's not just a organization here in the United States.
I was thinking about the investigations. Now, MUFON, is that like that's completely independent of any kind of government or state kind of groups?
Yeah. That's a good question. And there's been a lot of chatter about the fact that they are affiliated in some way, shape, or form with the CIA or the NRO or three-letter organizations. They have had Robert Bigelow involved with the organization, and where they set up what they call a star team. And where a really good case came along, they would let Bigelow know about it. And he was funding MUFON on a monthly basis with quite a substantial amount of money to have these investigators, on call 24/7, and then being able to go to these sites, collect the information, and then submit that information. And then who knows who Bigelow is involved with. That's a whole nother ball of wax. Anyway, the bottom line is that for complete transparency here, I'm also still a member of MUFON. I mean, just as a regular member, I'm not an investigator anymore. I don't do investigations for them anymore. But I'm also a member of the ERT, the Experiencer Resource Team, as a consultant, as a research consultant. We can talk a little bit about that, but maybe down the line here. Most of these investigations were done in conjunction with OPUS, the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support, which I mentioned earlier that I co-founded back in 1994, and which is a nonprofit 501c3 organization.
Yeah, I definitely want to get to that soon. I do want to ask about kind of a piggyback question for, say, I'm making a theoretical here, say like that there's a suspected or a suspicious crash site in New Mexico that MUFON hears about, and they want to send some investigators out, and then say that there's some sort of government is also tracking this event, and they send out the quote men in black. It's kind of like a murder scene where the state police show up, and you have the FBI and the local police, and they all want, they all kind of like are there for the same reason to investigate it, but they all have different policies and procedures, so they don't kind of necessarily work together, or some try to, bully the others away. Mm-hmm. Is that something that exists with between MUFON and like the government agencies at some of these investigations?
Well, I think what happens is that it's like who gets there first, and usually the government does. So you might be picking up the scraps after they've been there, so to speak. But what's happened is that there's a greater awareness now between first responders with regard to how to proceed in a case such as that, as you outlined here. And a gentleman by the name of Richard Lang has published a book for first responders on how to handle cases in these areas like the fire department or the police department. And that, of course, this would obviously be useful for our three-letter people, but they've been doing it for a lot longer than anybody. they have decided that they want to suppress a lot of information and keep it away from the public, unfortunately. But I think eventually, especially with these congressional hearings that have been going on, and
yeah,
this is going to open up more and more as we go forward. And hopefully, within your lifetime, guys, and hopefully mine.
Yeah, it certainly seems like there's every so often there's like a bigger news story that kind of hits somewhat mainstream media anyway. There's something you just said, and it came in and out of my head. I was going to ask about the stance is kind of like what you're saying, the suppression of information. This is like one of my favorite things to talk about with anything paranormal, because it really seems like so many powers that be go out of their way to suppress information. And I think there's whatever the reasons they may have, I'm not sure, it's kind of can just theorize, but what's the stance on a group such as MUFON in terms of sharing information or bringing, is there any kind of, do you feel like there's any kind of suppression as well? Or is that more of like, let's get the truth out to people?
Yeah, they have a what they call their CMS system, where all this cases are logged. It is available to all of the field investigators. It's also available to members. And also they supposedly now have instituted a whole new system, and they've divided these things up into various categories of what they're involved with, whether it's UFO shapes or cattle mutilation. They divided it all up as a lot more granular now, as far as what they're actually looking at. And they've parsed a lot of data and supposedly are going to be able to have that available to everyone. They're not trying to suppress it in any way, shape, or form. They've been brought up, so to speak, for not being as forthcoming in the past, but that's changed. They're trying to do the best they can with what resources they have, because they're a nonprofit organization as well. So it's not like, Bigelow with millions.
Yeah, and it makes sense that they're taking the approach like of really doing really thorough research, because kind of like what I was saying before, especially with anything considered paranormal and in this paranormal world and studies, it's like there's so much media attention that's given to the bad players, no matter what umbrella or, no matter what the topic is, whether we're talking about aliens or Bigfoot or ghosts, it's like there's so much attention given to when there's a failure or when there's an obvious misinformation or dishonesty, but there's so much more that could be shared in such a positive light. And I can imagine like it's probably important to groups like MUFON to really be able to stand behind their research, because they want to keep the credibility. So it makes sense like that there could be some suppression of that stuff if they had to. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Les, you mentioned a couple times that you started an organization called Opus, and I think we want to get into that because that's interesting. While MUFON is an international network to build a framework on investigations and kind of documenting them and all that good stuff, there is fallout from these encounters, and a lot of that is alien abduction, and people need a support group. And I think that was a void, correct? So can you talk a little bit about what MUFON tried to do and where you filled the gap?
Sure, absolutely. So to continue the story about how Opus came about, after I, started to hold these support group meetings in my office in San Jose, I got a call from the international director at the time and said, this reporter in your area would like to talk to an investigator, and can I give him your contact information? I said, sure. So the reporter came out and we had a nice conversation, and he wrote this article up in the Monterey Coast Weekly. And I got a call shortly thereafter by a woman living down in Carmel, California. She was asking me, how can I understand what's going on with my brain when I'm in contact with these off-earthly entities? You know, I'd like to understand that. And so I said to myself, I have no clue as to how I could possibly help her. But then she said she was working with an emergency room doctor down there at Carmel. That raised a flag for me because I had a doctor friend that was interested in connecting with other doctors that were interested in the phenomena and UFOs and things of that nature. So I called him up and I said, hey, why don't we go down there and see this lady? She's working with this doctor. You can meet him and let's see where this all goes. So we did. And as we walked into her home, there was a picture on the wall. And she's standing on the back of a rather large boat in these beautiful crystal clear blue waters. And I said, what's this all about? Oh, yeah, I was down in the Caribbean helping these treasure hunters. And I said, really, how were you helping these treasure hunters? Mm. He says, well, I was in contact with the captain of the galleon that had gone down. Mm. That started the afternoon off, like, you know, with, you know, raised eyebrows and all. But then we found out that after a near-death experience, she became very psychic. And so she started to be able to connect with these various entities. And we had a fascinating afternoon. She told us stuff about ourselves that there was no possible way she could know. She didn't know us from Adam, basically. So we came away and stopped at this hamburger joint. And we said, how the hell do we help people like this? It was, well, we got to put together an organization of some sort. So anyway, shortly thereafter, OPUS, the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support, was hatched. We decided that we wanted to do at least two things initially. And the first thing was to set up this confidential online support group, because people are having these experiences from all over the world. It's just not in one single area. And so you need to be able to give them a tool where they can connect with other people, no matter where the hell they are. And so that's what we did. And I tell you, it has proved to be probably the most helpful instrument for these people, because they can talk 24/7 with each other, talk about their experiences, ask questions. I mean, it's literally an amazing process that's going on. Then the second thing that we decided that was necessary, because we felt that these people would also need something beyond the support group. So we set up a referral network of mental health practitioners and hypnotherapists. We have them in this country, but we also have them in Europe. We have them in Australia. And so we're constantly looking for more therapists to come on board. And this is an interesting process, because a lot of therapists are not familiar with these phenomena. And so they don't have a basis when they're working with these people how to really approach it and how to handle it. But we're setting up now an educational part of our organization to then be able to give them the kind of tools that they need to move on. Now, the latest thing that we've done is to set up our EST, our Experiencer Support Team, which is basically people that have had a lot of experience in these phenomena. And we don't just simply focus in on UAP or abduction type things, but as it turned out, most of the people that do come to us have had those types of experiences. But if somebody comes to us with poltergeist activity or spiritual awakening or kundalini awakening or demon possession or things of that nature, we are able to send them to another organization that we are affiliated with so that they can get the kind of help that they need. Mm. And this has proved to be very, very helpful as well, the EST group. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. And once again, it was started in 1994, and it's a 501c3 nonprofit recognized by the IRS, which always cracks me up. Paranormal and the IRS.
You know, I think of this book. Do you know Dr. Eben Alexander by chance? He's a neurosurgeon. He wrote, I think, one of his more popular books is called Proof of Heaven. And this gentleman was somebody who was in the medical field, which very much discouraged, you know, the idea of NDEs and their existence, and kind of traded them off as nothing more than, you know, some sort of chemical imbalances when people are triggered or go on certain of, you know, deathly events. But then he has one himself, and he wrote this book about this amazing experience and how it's now shaped the rest of his life. And now he knows. But he was very, you know, honest and said when he came out to speak about this stuff, it's like this goes against, this flies in the face of his industry, what he was taught. So he's nervous about being, you know, basically excommunicated from his field. So what would you say to people that, like, how do you decipher when people kind of approach Opus and say they've had certain experiences? How much do you think are legitimate experiences versus somebody who might be experiencing just like a psychotic event or like a chemical imbalance of sorts?
Well, that's a good question. That a lot of the people that do come to us, first of all, you know, they say, you know, I thought I was going crazy. So I went to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and they told me that I didn't have a psychopathology. I was totally sane. Okay, so that's one group. Then you have people that come to you and tell you that they are schizophrenic, but they're on medication, but they've had these experiences. And I firmly believe that you can be schizophrenic and have an experience.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, and so I think there's a lot of things that we just truly, you can't just, because they say something like that or act like they're having that kind of thing. Because we've had people coming to us probably over the years that I've been involved, we've probably had a handful of people that really probably needed some further help mentally, mm-hmm. that we couldn't help them with.
Yeah.
So over the years, we have people in our group and our board that have the kind of credentials that can, you know, they see what's going on with this particular person, and they can make a recommendation that here's a therapist that I think you should go to and work with them for a while. And then if you want to come back, fine, you know?
Yeah.
We try to be as neutral and open when we're working with these people, because a lot of times this is the last place that they can get the help that they want. I mean, it's sad.
Yeah.
You take a look at Chris Bledsoe, you know, his book, The UFO of God, and all the stuff that he had to go through. His family thought he was crazy. His church members thought he was crazy. But the government didn't think he was crazy because, boy, did they come out and investigate the hell out of him.
Last 30 years, so 1994 to 2024, you've been around longer than most companies. Is your organization, is it set up kind of like MUFON where you get volunteers, or like you could get a person, you send out a manual and a person can do the online support? Or is it totally you've hired the staff and you're more, a little more expert in terms of that thing?
Yeah, we're totally volunteer. We have a board structure. Okay. I'm the chairman, and we have some really good people on the board. We have people that we work with sort of on a consulting basis at times, but mostly it's volunteer work. We survive on donations. So people are interested in helping an organization like us, go to our website at opusnetwork.org. We just had it redone, and I think the person that helped us with that did a fantastic job. And let me just tell you a little aside to this person that came on to help us on the website. I've been thinking about the fact that we needed to have the site updated. All of a sudden, one day, I get an email from this woman. And she said in her email that I've been told that I need to contact you to help you with the website. And I said, who told you? And then she said, the chorus that I work with. These are the entities that she works with, and she's written a couple of books herself. Her name is Katie Weiss. So it just absolutely blew me away to have something like that happen. You know, here you are, you're putting that intention out there, and then somebody shows up on your doorstep to help you out.
Yeah.
That absolutely blew me away.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so cool. It's like I don't believe in coincidences, and that's a great one right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about these types of experiences, and one of the support group meeting person said to me, I've seen you before. I said, really, where? UFO conference? No, I saw you on board the craft. I said, really? Oh, that's interesting. I kind of blew it off. It was like a year and a half later that a totally different person in the support group said the same thing to me. And I said, really, where? UFO? No, you were sitting on this bench naked and you were freaking out on board the craft and they told me to go over to you to calm you down. I said, okay, I got to go get regressed. Like I said, I had three separate regressions and had multiple past lives, but I did not find out anything along the lines of being on board a craft. Then I talked to a person again, maybe a few months later or something, telling him the story. And he said, well, maybe this person connected with you in a past life, and that's when they saw you. And this is the kind of stuff that blows your mind, because the manipulation of time and space and reincarnation is such a mechanism of the universe. Mm-hmm. There's been so many people that have come to our support group and talked about reincarnation that when in speaking with these aliens, they talk about it. They talk about it. Mm-hmm. Oh, once you start going down this rabbit hole, it gets really, really out there.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would be able to share or want to share about, like any particular people or people's experiences that that you've talked with that like really just kind of like that blew your mind? Or what kind of consistencies are there with people that experience?
Right. Yeah, sure. I wrote about this couple in my book. I wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Unknown Other and the Existential Proposition of Alien Contact, which is on Amazon. This couple, they're amateur pilots, young couple. They were picnicking in Butano State Park, north of Santa Cruz. They were coming out of the park at dusk. And this park is rather hilly. It overlooks the Pacific Ocean, of course. They noticed this light over the ocean. It was small at first, but it kept getting bigger and bigger until it was over their head. And it turned out to be a triangular craft about the size of a small Learjet. No sound whatsoever. Lights on the three corners, and it just slowly went into a canyon behind where they were. Then they noticed another light over the ocean. Same thing. This light got bigger and bigger till it was over their head, and it was again a triangular craft about the same size. It went into the canyon behind them. And the first one that they had noticed, they were looking at it. The second one, they felt it was looking at them. Then they became frightened. As I said, this is a rather hilly area, and it's pretty densely forested, and it's rocky as well. And so coming out of there at dusk, during the day, it's even hard to go down this trail because I had gone up there with them. This was one of the cases I had investigated. They felt all of a sudden like they were on automatic control, like they felt more robotic in nature, and they felt like they were drifting down out of the park to where their car was. When they reached their car, that was the last thing they remembered until 3 hours later when they showed up at a restaurant, which was normally only like 10 minutes away from where they were. They came to the support group meeting, and they had developed a rash after this. So they went to their doctor. I guess they went to two doctors, his doctor, then her doctor. And first one said, well, it's not poison ivy or poison oak, and there's a lot of poison oak up in that area. And the second doctor says, well, I don't know. It doesn't look like any of those. And is it maybe something, you know, a reaction to something? But I have no clue as to what it is. Anyway, they took a picture of their rash, and they brought it to the support group meeting. And they showed it around to the group, and almost without exception, they all said they had a similar rash at one time or another. And then one of the people in the group said, I'm pretty sure I know what it is. And so, of course, we said, what is it? And it said, it's a reaction to the fluid that they dip you in when they bring you on board the craft to sanitize you. Hmm. So now, okay, that was almost 30 years ago that this happened. I got a phone call from them. I think it's 3 months now, 3 months ago. She said, I can't believe it. I'm remembering now being dipped in that fluid.
Oh, wow.
So memories are starting to come back after a while. So things like this happen. It is just confirmation of things that are actually happening. And there's so many stories out there of these experiencers, so many.
Yeah.
The basics are the same, but the intimate details are different. They're taken through their, if they're at home, they're taken through a wall or through the ceiling, you know, or through a window, which is closed. They're brought up, you know, in a beam of light into the craft. They're laid on a table. They're examined. They're probed. Their fluids are taken, things of that nature. And then they're brought back with the wrong clothes or inside out.
Yeah.
Then they have physical marks on their bodies.
Yeah.
So, or they have implants.
Where are the implants, by the way? Implants, are they, and what are they? Do they differ or is it similar?
I don't know if you're familiar with the late Dr. Roger Lehr, who basically had excised from 17 patients their implant. He had submitted these implants that they removed, and they're all over. They're in different places. It could be in your arm, in your leg, in your neck, in your nose. You know, some of them have been found in somebody's brain, you know, after they've done an MRI on them. But as I said, he submitted these things to some highly respected labs and things to have it examined. So let me just read you what they found. First of all, there's no inflammatory rejection reaction by the body to these foreign objects, number one. No visible portal of entry. Collections of specialized nerve endings surrounding the object. An outer coating of ceramic biological material. A metallic phase where inorganic metal becomes biological tissue. The emission of radio waves, which are deep space frequencies in the FM band. So who's listening? Who's monitoring that? Electromagnetic fields in excess of 10 milligauss. Composition of meteoric iron 66. Rare earth metals such as U-236, a single isotope of uranium existing by itself, as well as elements such as iridium, which is very rare and hard to find in the Earth's crust. Non-terrestrial isotopic ratios indicating the involved elements did not come from Earth. So there's no proof, people, right?
Right.
There's no proof.
There's no proof. You said something very interesting with, I mean, everything's interesting, but when you were talking about the experience that a lot of people have in terms of the bigger events of an abduction and what differs is like the individual experiences within these bigger events. And that's exactly how I would describe people that do have experiences with NDEs. It's like there's a series of larger events that seem to coordinate and overlap, such as, you float above your body, you float out of your body, you have experiences with these beings of light, a life review of sorts. Like there's these major events that seem to be consistent with the experience, and the differences between them are just individual in nature. It's really cool to see that that's like a thing with abductions as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I was coming back from a conference and I ended up sitting next to a woman who was the head of St. Jude Hospital. And this is years and years ago. We started talking and she asked me, you know, where I was going or where I was coming from. Just small talk. And I told her I was coming back from a UFO conference. She looked at me and said, really? Oh, that's interesting. So then she said, I got to tell you a story. I said, what's that? She says, well, this was before I was running St. Jude. I was at a hospital. We were dealing with cancer patients. This woman was scheduled to go in for surgery one morning. So the doctors came in to get her to go in for the surgery. And she says, I don't need it. And they looked at her like, oh, is she freaking out? She doesn't want to have this operation. He says, no. They came last night and they took care of it. So they said, well, just to make sure, we're just going to take you in and do some x-rays and things of that nature. And so they took her in there and they lit her up and they found nothing. It was gone.
Yeah.
I talked to her a little bit later. It was like, yeah, these little guys came in and they took me up and took care of it. And
you know, there's a lot of theories of humans are kind of born into this existence with a veil between us and, you know, our souls or the beings that we truly are, and that we actually choose to come here for lessons. Like there's so many different kinds of theories of our existence, like what the point of us is. And I can't help but wonder, this is like also exists within such as things that we refer to as aliens, whatever that truly means. I don't know. We could be aliens. I wonder if there's like some kind of you know, whoever we are out in the universe, the universal souls that we are, when we choose to learn lessons and come here, is there an option where we can, hey, I want to be an alien and I want to abduct humans and study them? Like, I want that option.
No, I know where you're going with this. And that's interesting, because I think that our soul, that energy that we have, does not die. Mm-hmm. It goes on forever. And that you do incarnate into different situations, some of which I believe, yes, you have the option of choosing. Now, I was just talking about this the other day. One of the people in my book, Adam Burns, I just interviewed him. It's going to be on my YouTube site soon, talks about that. It's like this complicated process, you know, where you're this energy, your soul, if you will, goes out there, and then you have options to come back, and or you know, these walk-ins that happen, you know, with people.
Yeah.
That kind of thing going on. There's many layers of the process, evidently. It's something that is universal.
Yeah.
So it's just a different reality that we just certainly don't understand.
Right. Yeah.
I have a question about something we don't understand, is that hybrids. Have you ever met in your sessions a hybrid? I thought there was a story where there was a person that was a hybrid and their internal organs were different than ours. I don't know. I thought I heard that on a podcast at some point.
Yeah, I knew her. I knew her. And unfortunately, she's passed on. They were like in the wrong place. Stuff was in the wrong place. And her name is just eluding me right now. But I did talk about that. Matter of fact, I'm looking at a statue that she made. She was into sculpting. And so I got one of her sculptures of a alien gray female. And it's really, really kind of neat. But the hybrid situation is something that, you know, I was rather skeptical about it in the beginning. And, you know, the scientific community talks about the fact that, well, how can we gauge a person is a hybrid if we don't have samples of an alien DNA? Okay. I think maybe our government has samples of alien DNA. According to David Jacobs' latest book, I mean, they've perfected the hybridization process to the extent that you can't tell them apart from you and me.
Yeah.
So that's going on. And so what's the agenda? Why are they doing that? Is it some nefarious means of taking over, because eventually we will be them? Or is it something that's a survival mechanism that they need to do that to propagate their race in some small way instead of maybe the way they are now? But again, talking to Adam Burns a couple of days ago, it's more complicated than that. I don't think I really understood it.
Yeah, that makes sense, because it's like, you know, even on such a small level, if you look at like why humans make decisions that we do, it's like, it can be pretty complicated. So I would imagine like there might be a little nefarious actions. And there might be some based on survival. It's probably a mix of so many things. And like you're saying, beyond comprehension of us.
And even further complicates things, because Adam talked about the fact that there's like 86 races that are here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of them are positive. Some of them are negative. You know, they want to get rid of us, and the others are, you know, the positive ones are helping to not have that happen.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing.
I would love to hear, for those that want to like eradicate humans, I would be interested to know like why, what that is. And I would also, and vice versa, I would like to hear why we're worth saving on the other side of it.
Yeah. Well, I think as far as the negative ones, you know, we're screwing the planet up big time.
Oh, sure.
They're concerned about that, and that they figure if they could just wipe out humanity, then this whole process will stop.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Question I have, why do they care about Earth? Is this like a petri dish or a living lavatory where so many people from NDEs get sent back, and alien abductions, they send them back? Are we just kind of like a living lab for them to experiment and watch? What's so special about Earth? Would there be other labs that they could look at if we screw it up? What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I think we're dealing with this, some interdimensionalities here, where they exist here on this physical plane, but we can't see them because they're vibrating at a different frequency. They're just in a different dimension. So they're still part of this earth, if you will. And there's supposedly other civilizations that are physically here that we don't see because they've been able to hide themselves pretty well, whether it's under the ocean or someplace else deep in
Antarctica.
Yeah, Antarctica. There you go.
Yep.
And so there's so many possible scenarios as to the whys and wherefores of all this stuff. All we can do is conjecture about it. Say, well, does that make sense? Well, maybe. No, I don't think anybody has a definitive answer. We all have bits and pieces of the puzzle, and it's starting to come together a little bit more, but still, I think we have a long way to go to really understand.
But I'm curious for folks like myself and Bob, I think part of the reason this podcast exists and why you did the documentary is, you know, outside of the search for answers, it's almost like I'm compelled outside of just being, I don't know what what drives me, I don't really know other than curiosity, but there's a reason that I'm curious about all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And every time we talk with guests on here, it always like inspires me to want to do more, to do something about it. And checking out Opus here, I'm actually looking at the website, and it's a beautiful website, by the way, and checking it out. And it's just like, I don't know if I'm qualified to help in something like that you guys have going on. I mean, it's pretty impressive what you all do there.
We're always looking for people with talent like yourself that are interested in helping. And I'm open to talking to anyone if we can put something together that makes sense for both sides, then I'm all for it. So yeah, I would love to talk to you more about these kind of things.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting. You know, there's been a couple of times over in this past 30 years that I've said, okay, I'm done.
Yeah.
Hold up my tent, you know, and go play cards somewhere or something. But all of a sudden, something starts to happen. I start getting more phone calls, more people are contacting me. It's like I'm compelled to move forward. So I think my mission, okay, and I think they, whoever they are, is kind of moving me in this direction. You know, from that first sighting when I was 11 years old, and then the subsequent seeing Stanton Freeman, and then I just continue to move forward on this thing. And I feel very compelled to continue to do what I'm doing.
Yeah, and that it's interesting because Craig Campobasso, who we mentioned earlier, when we talked to him on the podcast, one of the things I was curious about is why certain people seem to get visited more than others, or what kind of prompts the initial meeting, like why them, like why these people. And one of the things that he mentioned was that there's a theory that aliens really see when other people are trying to help or make things better for other, you know, make the world, their experience, the universe a better place. Mm-hmm. And that there's almost like some sort of priority to people who are on that mission, so to speak. So that just aligns with what you're saying. It's like you, whatever this compulsion is for you, mm-hmm. You feel like there's something kind of driving you every time you kind of want to hang it up. Mm-hmm. It's like, like you're saying, I think there's something there. They see you helping and they want that to continue.
Yeah. It's kind of like the paranormal. I mean, I've had these experiences, Kyle. Once I reach out, I could get like, once I started doing, EVPs, I started getting a ton of them, you know, and I had to kind of just stop because it was coming too easily. It's like almost once you open a door, there's like almost like a radar on you that opens it even more for you. Yeah. Sounds like it's the same way with aliens, mm-hmm. and contact there, correct, Les? Or what's your thought on that?
Well, I tell you, you know, it's compelling that the type of a feeling that one has when you're doing something like this. I always wondered, and I had this interview with Adam Byrne, he talks about the fact that these aliens wanted him to write this book. He wants him to put the word out, wants him to explain what happened to him. And they're doing this process right now. And I think these are the quote unquote good guys, if you will, that want people to put the story out there. and to make it more palatable and to make it more communicative in a way that people will say, okay, this is something that is happening to this person. They've struggled with it, but now they're through it. And what have they learned? You know, they've learned their worldview has changed, that we need to be better stewards of the planet. We need to be better to one another. We need to be more loving. I mean, these are all positive things. And if all these experiencers come away with that same feeling, and then people that don't have that feeling read books like this and get that feeling from the book, I mean, that's really great. You know, if we all, you know, not have to worry about the Russians and the Ukrainians fighting and the Israelis and the Palestinians fighting and all these wars, and mm-hmm. we could spend all that money on something totally different, taking care of the planet and taking care of ourselves. And
yeah, I can imagine, like, from their point of view of how silly earthly matters can appear.
You know, it's like the male ego gets involved, and then all these guys, well, we gotta take over this territory. What a waste. Yeah. What a freaking waste. I think we need to have the women take over.
Yeah. I always wonder what happens to the people with the strongest egos when they die. And if it is, in fact, where you become part of everything, that must be like so hard for a person with a huge ego. You know,
I'm not sure if you've heard much or know much about the Miami Mall. I don't know if that ended up just being first, do you know much about that?
Yeah, I tried to read up on that as best I could. And what I read about it was that there was a group of kids, I don't know how old they were, but they were blowing fireworks off.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused a ruckus. I think it was some kind of a ploy to mention the fact that they saw these aliens or something.
Yeah, that's the thing, because it's like, you know, I follow a lot of alternative media, I'll say. And that's like the narrative that is being propagated. However, what I find interesting, and again, it's, I don't know what's real, what's not. So this is just the interesting stuff to me, is like the night that it happened, there's very, very, very little video footage of it. And there's one clip in particular, it's very popular. It's from someone who's kind of looking down at it from their apartment, this mall, but it's just there's a few interesting things. One is the amount of police activity there. I mean, it looks like the entire city of cops. There must be 100 cop cars there, right? The story when it broke was that there were some teenagers that either got into a fight or where there was gunshots. There was basically some activity or they were fighting. And that was the story. But it just seems, if that's the story, there's a couple of things that were inconsistent with, like, why would that amount of cops show up? Because that's inconsistent with any other response in history. But also from some of the people that were in the mall, supposedly there's a bunch of people that were forced to sign NDAs on their experience inside the mall.
Yeah.
There have been people that said, because there's cameras in the mall, and yet nobody, and they refused to release any footage of anything that was happening inside the mall. So it's just a few suspicious things going on, while there's people that have gone on record saying that there were some sort of being, tall men, gray men, aliens, some people called them, that kind of disappeared and appeared. The shooting were actually for in self-defense because they were so scared. I don't know what to believe. It's just an interesting thing going on.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of facts in there that when you put it all together, it doesn't make sense. But I think in response to possible shootings, I think we're so sensitized now to these types of things that the police in any city are going to have a massive reaction.
Sure. Yeah, it makes sense.
And of course, there was that case out in California where that homeowner said that this alien was in the backyard.
Oh, yeah. I saw that one, too. Very interesting.
Yeah. Of course, you haven't heard much more about that either.
Yeah. Makes you wonder why.
That one sounded even a better situation as far as being a reality. But again, you just don't hear about
it. Yeah.
So, Les, it brings us to the end of this interview. I did have one question, but it's kind of a sweeping question.
Mm-hmm.
Look, there's a lot of bad stuff going around. People are like, a lot of suicides. A lot of people want to leave this world and don't come back. But why, in your opinion, is now a great time to be alive?
Oh, my goodness. Well, for me being involved with this whole phenomena, and that I've always believed that they were real based on when I saw that object when I was 11. And nobody could dissuade me from the fact that this wasn't what I saw. It's confirmation for me that, you know, with these congressional hearings going on and Grush saying, hey, yeah, we got crashed UFOs, we got bodies, we got all this stuff. And I could take you to where it is. So for me, it's, like I say, confirmation. And it's very exciting to see in these congressional hearings the bipartisanship that's going on. You had the Republicans and Democrats agreeing to something in there, which blew me away. Some of the most boisterous Republicans and some of the wild Democrats in there, you know, that normally don't like talking to one another, got together and actually asked good questions and were on the same page. So hopefully we will get more information going forward in 2024. So like I say, hopefully within our lifetimes, guys, we'll have the revelation that, guess what? We are definitely not alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think the times to be alive would be maybe to meet Jesus Christ. Uh-huh. And then also now to see kind of what's happening. So with that said, hey, thanks so much for your time today. I would want to give you a moment to plug your website, the book you wrote, where they can get it, and your YouTube site and anything else, you know, if you want to promote how to support the Opus organization, how they can do that. Would love you to take a minute now to do that, Les.
Well, thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate being here. And thank you for what you guys do, because it's important that you're providing a service to get the word out to the public. And so that's great. And it's very important. Yeah, Opus, we're a nonprofit organization. We depend on donations. So if you go to our website, opusnetwork.org, there's a donate button there. We would greatly appreciate it. If you know of any therapists that might be interested in working with us on a referral basis, we are always looking for more therapists, whether they're hypnotherapists or mental health practitioners. Also, we do have a YouTube channel where there's a lot of the interviews that I do on there. And we'd love you to go there. It's when you go into YouTube, you put in Opus separate word network. It'll take you to that site. Please hit the subscribe button because that helps us with YouTube eventually trying to do a little money raising there. And I have a book that's on Amazon. It's called The Unknown Other and the Existential Proposition of Alien Contact, which I talk about the physical, the psychological aspects of these people having these abductions, as well as some other interesting information I think that you would enjoy. So again, guys, thank you so much.
Les, thank you. Really riveting stuff. We always love the conversations we have, right, Kyle?
Yeah, so good. This is so fun.
Yeah, you brought some great stuff. Kyle, I was thinking after this interview, you would probably, maybe I'd be a MUFON investigator and you'd be on the other thing, you know?
I was thinking that the whole time. I'm like, oh, I gotta look into this. I'm gonna reach out to you again, Les, if that's cool about the Opus.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I do need to end this episode on a bit of a somber note. Comes with a heavy heart to say that Brad Little Frog Hudson passed away on February 2nd, 2024. Brad had a sudden brain hemorrhage early in the morning, and he passed away peacefully. Brad was instrumental in the documentary Afraid of Nothing. When I met him, he was actually my inspiration to do it. He was the first guest on this podcast. He was the first guest on season 2, and we'll miss him immensely. So I thought it would be appropriate to share in Brad's own words what he believes happens when we pass and what he felt is the most important thing for us all to do while we are alive on this earth before we move on to our next destination. So this is from an interview with Brad, my very first interview from the Afraid of Nothing documentary. Here's the audio.
When this physical shell ceases to operate, we experience a seamless transition. We do not lose consciousness. We merely stand up. We are in a new body, and we are perfectly healthy because we are no longer in this third dimension. We are now in the fourth dimension, the transitory dimension. From here, we enter the tunnel of light, which everyone has heard about, which is actually a pathway to our true home, which is in the fifth dimension. The fifth dimension is a world of pure love. There is no negativity there whatsoever. It is just love. And that's where we live. And that's why we have to come here to learn lessons about love and forgiveness. We are creators. We are part of the divine. And we can manifest anything that we want as long as we come from a place of joy and happiness. I'd like to encourage everyone to focus on love and forgiveness and joy and laughter and let everything else go, because love is the most important thing in the universe.
You've been listening to the Afraid of Nothing podcast. Please subscribe and like us on Facebook. Until next time, stay scared.
Hey, you're still here? Great. Then why not listen to another episode? Visit afraidofnothingpodcast.com to peruse all the shows. That's afraidofnothingpodcast.com. And while you're there, click the coffee cup icon to buy me a coffee and leave a review. I'll give you a shout out in an upcoming episode, and the world will know how swell you are.